You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped, first broadcast on the 19th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ. And welcome to the 12th edition of Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ on Monocle 24. Produced from our studios in Tokyo, Hong Kong and Singapore, and at Midori House right here in London, this is your unmissable weekly briefing from the world's most dynamic region. I'm your host, Ben Rylan. Coming up in the program, we'll pour ourselves a glass of cachaça and spare a thought for those unfortunate Australians who can't.
They're all very sweet drinks because, as you'll see if we try this cachaça, cachaça has a very strong flavour. So it's nice if you can distill it with a lot of sugar, and Brazilians have a sweet tooth generally.
Then we'll check in with our Tokyo bureau to sample some of the rotating array of desserts on offer at the city's convenience stores.
Even the big producers are constantly innovating. They're constantly looking for new recipes, for new combinations of flavors. And so for anyone who's into processed food or food in general, I think it's just a great market to just try lots of stuff.
And later in the show, we'll look at efforts by Singapore to boost its national identity with beautifully designed souvenirs.
We get like 5 local designers to design something, and then you produce them for us. So we have good Singapore design, super high quality workmanship, and at affordable price.
All that right here on Asia Pac Unwrapped with me, Ben Rylan. I'm Ben Rylan, and this is Asia Pac Unwrapped, where we take a closer look at the world's most dynamic region and explore emerging opportunities. Any cocktail-sipping connoisseur has likely stumbled upon Brazil's favourite spirit at some point. Cachaça is a staple of several South American drinks, and with about 1 billion bottles sold every year, it's a lucrative business to be in. Yet while international interest in the spirit has increased in recent years, 99% of the world's cachaça bottles are uncorked on Brazilian shores. But while some producers try to ignite more international interest, importers in Australia are frustrated by their government's ban on selling cachaça. A bizarre 114-year-old law in Australia places cachaça in the same category as rum, whiskey and brandy, meaning that it must be matured in wood for at least 2 years. Brazil's government has complained to Australian authorities, but there's no word yet on a potential law change. We sent our Melbourne contributor Stephen A. Russell along for a chat with Greg Sanderson, owner of the Eau de Vie cocktail bar and newly opened whiskey joint, Boilermaker House.
So basically, the Brazilian government has come to our Australian government and argued over old importation laws which categorise cachaça in with rum, which means it has to be aged for a minimum of 2 years before it's allowed into the country under such labels, where cachaça is a very different spirit. A lot of cachaça is drunk unaged. Some of the premium ones are aged like a rum, but it's definitely not a rum. And these laws are very, very old that the Australian government is sticking to. And it's about time we refresh them.
So maybe, first of all, just explain to me then what it is and how it differs from rum.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of evidence pointing towards that cachaça predates rum. So, I mean, it's never really copied how rum is produced. It's always set its own standards. It is made from sugarcane juice, not molasses, which most rum is made from. There are some rums that are made from sugarcane juice, true, but the distillation techniques are totally different. I mean, they can add a little bit of corn and maize into their ferment. They can do pot distillation, column distillation, the flavour is distinctive. You can always pick a cachaça, you get that raw grassiness. The way that you drink it is different. The Brazilian government has never tried to pass it off as a rum. It is its own category. Just because it's made from sugarcane shouldn't typecast it to a rum. It's like saying Finlandia vodka is an unaged Scotch whiskey because they're both made from barley. It's totally different.
And so what's the Brazilian government looking to achieve then, and how would that change the market here?
They're just trying to import without meeting the legislation of what we think that has to be met. Brazil has been making this spirit longer than Australia has been around. So for an Australian government to say it must be this to bring into our country is a bit ridiculous. We are definitely the hardest country in the world to get spirits into. That law comes from a long time ago where, you know, there's an Australian rum that probably had a lot to do with that, that law coming in. They've had this trouble in a few countries around the world. We're not the first. They had to, you know, change alcohol contents and labelling for the US to break into there. So they've done it before, but they've found Australia particularly hard. They're just trying to... It is their national spirit. I believe last time I checked, it was the third biggest spirit drunk in the world. So number one is shochu, number two, cachaça, number three, vodka. So why should the Australian government go back to them and tell them what their national spirit is? We should just be able to bring it in.
And it does beg the question, what exactly is the problem? Why is it that the government has an issue with it as is, and why can't it just be freely imported?
The Australian government's problem is that they haven't updated their laws since, I think, 1901, where they probably hadn't heard of cachaça. Our only problem is not being reactive to new spirits that are, well, not a new spirit, but a spirit we've found out about. The Australian government is not changing, and for a law to not change in over 100 years is very a backwater way to look at things.
And there are quite a few big voices behind sort of backing up the Brazilian side of the campaign. I understand Diageo is one of the sort of players saying that this should change.
Yeah, I mean, Diageo is mainly in the whiskey industry, vodka and gin, but Diageo's voice to the Australian government is that we punish, in a way, spirit drinkers over beer and wine drinkers, and spirit producers, even the spirit producers here in Australia, it's so much harder to open a distillery here in Australia than anywhere else in the world. It's so much harder to bring spirits in here because of the taxation laws. Once you go over 40%, it increases. All Diageo is saying to the Australian government that the tax should be on alcohol percentage, regardless of the form it comes in.
And we have got some great spirit players here. I mean, locally in, well, Melbourne and Perth, I understand you've got West Winds Gin, you've got things like Lark Whiskey doing really good down in Tasmania. Should we be encouraging a bit more support in the spirit industry, whether it's international or at home?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely should be encouraging homemade spirits, because what it's done for Scotland, what it's done for, you know, even Ireland and America, in the certain areas that produce spirits, those areas become a tourist attraction. Local bars in, you know, Melbourne and Sydney can sell Australian spirits. You know, it's a national product for a lot of countries. And what it's done for Brazil is create a national drink. A cachaça is, you know, used in the Caipirinha cocktail. That's why most bars around the world stock it, because that cocktail is so popular. So I think encouraging spirit production in Australia is only good for our economy, tourism and exportation.
That was Stephen A. Russell there in conversation with bar owner Greg Sanderson in Melbourne. Now, I've just ducked out of Studio One at Midori House and across the road to a bar because, being Australian, I'm sad to admit that I too have never tried cachaça. But my colleague Gaia Lutz here at Monocle grew up in Rio de Janeiro, and she certainly has. Gaia, we've got some cachaça here in front of us. Now, just looking at the bottle, what can you tell me about cachaça and its place in Brazilian culture?
Cachaça is a hugely popular drink in Brazil. It has enormous historical value, also cultural and economical. I don't have the figures of the economy around cachaça, but it is massive. You know, we're one of the biggest sugarcane producers in the world. But historically and culturally, it's massive because two of our most famous cocktails, perhaps two of our only famous cocktails, are made of cachaça. That's the caipirinha and the batida de coco. So the caipirinha, obviously, is the most well-known one. It's a mix of fruits, normally lime, sugar, lots of ice, and cachaça. And the batida de coco is made out of coconut milk. It's a more like a dessert-y, like sort of more of a filler. Coconut milk, sugar, and cachaça. And as you can see, they're all very sweet drinks, because as you'll see if we try this cachaça, cachaça has a very strong flavor. So it's nice if you can distill it with a lot of sugar. And Brazilians have a sweet tooth, generally.
Excellent. All right, well, I'll let you do the honors by cracking open the bottle.
And so what we're going to do here now, we're going to try something, another version, which is the most popular version of cachaça, which is pinga com mel, which is the cheapest sort of you can find in any bar in Rio. It costs about R$3, which is a pound. So it's a shot of cachaça, and they mix it with honey, sometimes lemon or cinnamon. But, in old times, it was thought that it was, you know, going to cure colds and so on. I still think it does, because you're going to feel the heat rush. Normally, you can dose your own honey, but I normally put a lot because it is very strong.
So I just poured a shot of cachaça and we're drizzling some honey into it. All right, I'm going to drizzle my own.
So this you can find in any bar, and you can find a lot of drunk people off this because it's very cheap. It's our equivalent, I say, of vodka in Russia. It's incredibly cheap for business. Cheers.
Cheers. Oh, it has quite a hit to it, doesn't it? Wow.
Very strong. It's very strong, and I think that's why we tend to do. And for the caipirinha, for example, you can mix it with so many variations of fruit. So I think in Europe and all over the world, it got popular with lime. But in Brazil, we drink it with passion fruit, with berries, with any sort of fruits. You can make a wonderful caipirinha. And the trick is a lot of sugar, cane sugar, because it's, as you can see, it's quite pungent.
I think we should continue this shot of cachaça and perhaps get back to the show. Guy Lutz, thank you very much for joining us on Asia Pac Unwrapped.
Thank you. Cheers.
Still to come on today's show, we'll browse Singapore's efforts to boost its national identity with beautifully designed souvenirs. But up next, it's dessert time in Tokyo. You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
This is Asia Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. Now, Tokyo is known for many things: rapid transport, amazing restaurants, sleek urban organization. But cake and ice cream isn't exactly an obvious part of the city's mystique. For convenience stores, however, igniting excitement among consumers with the next dessert craze can mean big business. Product lines must attract an almost instant following if they're to avoid falling out of Japan's retail realm. Well, Monocle's Asia editor-at-large Kenji Hall has popped over to 7-Eleven just across from Monocle's Tokyo bureau. Kenji, what have you got for us to sample?
I have just traipsed over to 7-Eleven and picked up a half dozen different types of sweets from the freezer section. These are ice creams, but they're not really traditional ice creams. You know, they come in different shapes and forms and have different types of ingredients. And there always seems to be an emphasis on where the ingredients are from. For instance, I have a milk bar, and it's just called Simple Milk Bar, and it's made by Glico, which is one of Japan's big food and sweets makers. And it's cream and condensed non-fat milk from Hokkaido, made into what an American would call a popsicle, what, you know, someone else from the Commonwealth would call an ice lolly. And, you know, that's the selling point. It's simple frozen milk. There's this other thing that comes in, you know, those energy packs that you squeeze and suck on the opening to, you know, get protein or maybe to rehydrate. This is an ice cream that's drinkable, and it's called Cool-ish.
Is it Cool-ish or is it mighty cold? What would you say?
It's frozen, but it's not quite hard. So maybe that's why it's called Cool-ish. I'd have to ask the producer. There's one that's an Azuki Monaka. So it's Azuki ice cream in the form of a Monaka treat. And, you know, again, they talk about the Azuki, the red bean that's in it, and how it has just a tad bit of salt that brings out the sweetness of the bean. Another nice one. There's a long seller. You ask anyone in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and they know this sweet because it's been around forever. It's called Gari Gari Kun. And it's suika, which is watermelon. But if you look at the label, there isn't any watermelon in the treat.
Would you say that the preferred flavors for Japanese desserts, they are quite different to the rest of the world? Does that really stand out when you're browsing the variety on offer at your local 7-Eleven?
Well, I think what you have to keep in mind is that Japanese sweets are actually not that sweet. And, you know, I come from the United States where everything is way too sweet. Here, it's just sweet enough. It's actually perfect for me. And so when you get this simple milk bar, for instance, it's going to actually taste like milk. Maybe a little bit sweeter than milk, but the sweetness is not amped up to the extent that, you know, you get a toothache because it's so sweet. I think the other thing to keep in mind here is that these sweets in the freezer section in 7-Eleven and in the other convenience stores, such as Lawson or Family Mart, they will change constantly. Producers only get about 3 weeks during which, you know, they can put their new product on the shelf. If it doesn't sell, the convenience store removes it from the shelves. This is how the convenience store gets customers to keep coming into the store, because every time the customer comes into the store, he or she knows that there will be something new, and usually it's seasonal. So this phrase, kisetsu gente, which means limited offer only for the season, is a great way of getting customers to keep coming back. If we switch topics slightly and talk about drinks, every year in Japan, there are 1,500 different types of new drinks released. Some of them actually make it to, you know, beyond week three. Some die on the vine. You know, so it's a market that's extraordinarily dynamic. Producers, even the big producers, are constantly innovating. They're constantly looking for new recipes, for new combinations of flavors. And so for anyone who's into processed food or food in general, I think it's just a great market to just try lots of stuff.
What's your preference on the variety you've picked up today?
I would actually go for the simplest one. I'd go for the cream and non-fat condensed milk. And I'm really curious about this because, you know, there's all this effort to make everything seem like it's not. And this one seems to be the most authentic. It's saying, you know, we're only putting sugar and cream and condensed milk in it. And it is what it is. And hopefully that's what it's going to taste like. I mean, I like to be surprised. And at the same time, I can appreciate the fact that they have gone to a lot of effort to make this extraordinarily simple.
Well, go on. You've been talking to us about this particular one for a while. You're going to need to take a bite and tell us what it tastes like.
All right. Here we go. Delicious. It's exactly as I thought it would be. It's milk, frozen milk, but ever so slightly sweetened. Very, very nice. Very refreshing. Perfect for this kind of weather. It's about 30 degrees or more outside today. Bright, sunny, clear day. So this is the perfect dessert. For me, at least.
That was Kenji Hall there, Monocle's Asia editor at large. I'm Ben Rylan, and this is Asia Pack Unwrapped, in association with ANZ. While Singapore is this year celebrating its 50th anniversary of independence, in some respects, the culturally diverse country hasn't quite defined its own national character. Supermama, formed by industrial designer Edwin Low, has made its mission to explore Singapore's national identity through its range of beautifully designed souvenirs. The brand's wares, which draw inspiration from many cultures that have made up the island nation, have enjoyed tremendous success. It's not just tourists taking home these pieces either. As Low tells Monocle's Nolan Giles, it's the connection Supermama has made with Singaporeans that has guaranteed its business success.
We started Supermama 4 years ago. So the whole idea is we were working full time, and me and my wife, we decided, okay, let's stop and try something new. So what we did is we sold our home. With the cash proceeds, we started Supermama. It's a design shop. So we were located at a shop house, secluded shop house within City Hall. And that's how it all began.
And I understand you were working as a design lecturer beforehand, and you said something to your students that kind of made you think.
Yes, it's a crazy question. I was asking them, a lot of them, and how many of you wants to set up your own business, design business, whether is it to run your own design consultancy or to create a design shop? Almost 100% of them raised up their hands. Next question I'd ask, how many of you would be willing to give up everything just to pursue this dream? Zero. It's crazy, right? So I thought, being a lecturer, maybe the issue is with me and not with my students. And I began to question myself, what is my dream? So I'm an industrial designer by training. And obviously, one dream is to start a design shop that I can sell things that I like. I can produce good Singapore content. but why didn't I do it? And maybe the whole idea is about me doing it first, then I can get the next generation to do it.
So you did it, you started the business.
Yes, we started business. We don't have a lot of money, which also means that the first year, we didn't even spend a single cent on branding and on marketing at all. It's purely word of mouth. And from that, it all began. For the first 2 years, was really, really tough. We were neither losing money, nor were we making money. And that's the tough thing. You don't know how to move forward, right? If it's losing money, you can just say, enough, I'm not going to move forward. If it's making money, well done, let's go. But you're neither here nor there. But the turning point for us began when we were in year three, where we got access into a lot of Japanese crafts industry, which includes Kihara that produces the porcelain pieces for us.
So let's hear a little bit about Kihara and how that came about 3 years into your business.
Right. Kihara is really interesting. They set up a kind of roadshow in Singapore, and I happened to pass by and I realized that, hey, they're really selling super high quality Japanese porcelain at half the price that I'm selling in my shop. This is really crazy. Went up to them, I talked to them, and I realized that they were the makers. They make the porcelain themselves. And that's the reason why the price point is super. And what we did is then we introduced our concept. Why not we get like 5 local designers to design something and then you produce them for us. So we have good Singapore design, super high quality workmanship and at affordable price. So that was a turning point because when we launched, everybody wanted a piece of that blue-white porcelain. And I remember at the end of the third year, we actually won the President's Design Award for that collection.
Let's talk about the ideas behind the design and what's made those 5 designs so popular. You know, what did you ask of your designers and how did they interpret that and how does that relate back to Super Mama?
If you look at design in general, or when you look at the porcelain pieces or souvenirs designed in Singapore in general, you realize that there is a lack of meaningful content. They are usually just some graphic icons and with no depth to it. What I did is I gave the designers a brief, and that is they have to create something real, something that everybody is familiar with, that even the locals love it. You know, Super Mama is pretty much a souvenirs shop, a gift shop. We want to encourage people to give, and that is the reason why we are so inspired by the culture, the giving culture in Japan. And when we started the Singapore Icon series, the brief was to define and select a part of Singapore that is real and then interpret it into contemporary tableware. So that was a brief given to them. And when we launched, everybody loved it because everybody recognized the graphics. If you're Singaporean, you will recognize the graphics. The best compliment, obviously, is one by a journalist. His name is Wei. He kind of told me, hey, Edwin, this is HDB. You know, 80% of Singaporeans stay in a HDB flat. But this is the first time that when I saw a gift, it makes me so proud of staying in a public housing. So I think that really sets the tones for the future collection.
In terms of what you've done here as a business, it's quite bold, especially in this culture in Singapore. I'd love to hear a little bit about the challenges of launching a startup like this here. And perhaps, you know, a little bit of advice for designers that might be interested in following your lead.
Super Mama is never meant to exist. We hope that, you know, we are thinking, okay, after the first year of Super Mama, if you're not doing well, you just close and go back to the full-time job. It's nice. It's blissful, you know. But I'm really thankful that we are still around. I don't have any advice, but what I know is every time when I earn certain amount of money, I throw it back to the business. And I pray that the next investment would bring me a good yield. When it brought me a good yield, boom, I threw it back in again. I threw it back. So I don't really calculate, but I go by a gut. I think we must be confident to follow our gut. I think that's one of the most important things. And then after we are satisfied with what our heart tells us, let's go down to what our minds have to say, right? Okay, now then you have to look at the sum. Then you have to look at the numbers.
That was Monocle's Singapore Bureau Chief Nolan Giles there in conversation with Edwin Lowe. This is Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. Up next, we'll touch down for 24 hours in Hong Kong. You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. Now imagine for a moment you've just stepped off a flight in Hong Kong for a layover. You've only got 24 hours, but why not use that time to see what the city has to offer? Where would you go and what would you see? Well, we sent this show's researcher, Kurt Lin, to walk us through 24 hours in his city.
After hopping off the plane, the first sip of coffee should be at Coco Espresso on Stanley Street in Central. Our Hong Kong Brew's favourite coffee shop should give you a good dose of caffeine to keep up the energy to explore the Central and Soho area in the morning. For breakfast in Hong Kong, an authentic dim sum tea house Lin Hung Lo. A restaurant filled with the old Cantonese ambience and service cannot be missed. If chicken feets give you too much of a surprise in the morning, hagao, siumai, beef balls are the conventional delicate options for everyone. For the proper etiquette in a tea house, please bring along a Hong Kong Monocle travel guide and turn to page 41. It will give you some good insights. Then I'll take a mid-morning walk through to the west, to Shengwan, an area with a good mix of expats and local inhabitants' lifestyle. Walk up to the hill to Hollywood Road. Visit Mammal Temple. The gods in there are for the ambitious minds. In the ancient Chinese time, people prayed to the mammal god for success in exams and blessing on career. After, I'll head to Taiping Shan Street, tucked away in the leafy back street. The whole area is home to some of the Hong Kong's best boutiques, galleries, and cafe. For lunch, if you want a lighter option, I'll have to stop to Paul's Atelier for some good bakery around the world, or the next door Cafe Dead End to grab a sandwich. If you want something with more flavors, I'll go back to Hollywood Road and order one Neapolitan pizza at 208. Followed by some shopping at PMQ on Aberdeen Street, a building used to be a dormitory for public servants. The units in the premise have now transformed into design studio, independent shops, and some space for exhibitions. PMQ is a good example of building conservation in the city. Time for dinner. I'll go to Ho Lee Fook on Elgin Street. The Taiwanese and Canadian chef Mr. Yu will give you a good idea of what modern Chinese cuisine should be. And for a nightcap, I'll go for a couple of drinks at Cafe Grey, sitting at the top floor of Upper House Hotel in Admiralty, enjoying the skyline of Kowloon with a glass of Earl Grey Martini or any other options on the Michelin menu that almost never disappoints. After some drinks, it's probably time for bed. I'll book into Grand Hyatt on the harbourside in Wan Chai. This has been our top pick for those doing business here. Book a last bar appointment at 10:30. Should be a good ending of a long day exploration. And back in the room with a mesmerizing view of Victoria Harbour. Getting ready yourself for the departure flight, leaving this vibrant, energetic city in a few hours. For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Kurt Lin.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. The show was produced by our studios in Tokyo, Hong Kong and Singapore and by me, Ben Ryland, here at Midori House in London. Nina Norek was our editor and Kurt Lin was our researcher. Asia Pac Unwrapped is back at the same time next week. That's 7 a.m. Monday in Sydney, 9 a.m. in Wellington and 2200 hours on Sunday here in London. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or tune in via iTunes, SoundCloud or the Monocle app. This is Asia Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. Until next time, I'm Ben Ryland. Enjoy your week.